Okay, so this talk's on class, and I'm assuming it's not really going to surprise most people when I say that the world is class divided. It is. And some of this is visible in your day-to-day life. You know, you go down the Centrelink office, you can see a lot of poverty. You know, you take a drive down Toorak, you can see a whole lot of wealth. But there's something about our immediate experience of society that covers up the true extremes of rich and poor. And so I want to give people a sense of it. You know, we worry about being able to afford the rent or paying mortgages on a house or buying a car. But, like, to the rich, this is an utter triviality. And so here's a quote from Warren Buffett, who I think he's about the third richest man in the world now. And, you know, he's a real asshole. And so he says, "I don't have a problem with guilt about money." Oh, isn't that nice? "The way I see it is that my money represents an enormous number of claim checks on society. It's like I have these little pieces of paper that I can turn into consumption. If I wanted to, I could hire 10,000 people to do nothing but paint my picture every day for the rest of my life." That's the kind of person we're up against. Now, in 2008, he was valued at $62 billion. And that is almost double what the United States has spent on reconstruction in Iraq. But the statistics are worse than just that. The three richest people in the world own more than the 600 million poorest. Like, and that's mind-blowing. You know, you think about 600 million people, like, that's a lot of people. And there's three people that own as much as them. And that's a more eloquent argument for revolution than I think, you know, anyone can make. Like, if you're not talking about taking the wealth of the rich and giving it back to the rest of us, like, you're talking crap. But the issue is, this is not enough for us to go on if we want to actually overturn society. You know, there have been wealth divides, not this extreme, but there have been wealth divides for a whole lot of human history. You know, you go back to ancient societies, there was a wealth divide. The central contention of Marxism, however, is that, and socialism, is that it is now possible to destroy the class system and the wealth divide once and for all. And so Marx's argument is that there's something different about the world today that makes that possible. And Marx argued, correctly, that with the advent of capitalism, for the first time, the world is able to produce enough to meet human need. And, you know, I've got a few statistics to prove that. The military spending of the United States alone would be enough to provide the entire world with food and shelter. They spent, a couple of years ago, $626.1 billion. Obama's just put out a budget which is higher than that, over $700 billion on the military. And you compare that figure to what is estimated would be necessary to meet basic human need. They reckon that $19 billion would eliminate starvation and malnutrition. $12 billion would provide education, basic education for every child. $15 billion would provide access to water and sanitation. And $23 billion would reverse the spread of AIDS and malaria. So, you know, those are relatively small figures compared to what the United States spends on its army. The other example is, of course, the United States Reserve Bank. Spending billions and billions of dollars to bail out banks, trillions of dollars to bail out banks. Instead, they could use that money to meet human need. So the problem's not scarcity. That's key. In the past, you know, 500, 1,000 years ago, the problem was scarcity. It is not the problem anymore. It is rather the lack of a political willpower on the part of the rulers to do anything about the massive inequality in the world. And it is key to see this is not the fault of the poor of the world or even the workers of first world countries. I mean, it's, you know, logical to say if there were a vote, if people were asked, should there be starvation, should there be homelessness, people would say no. It's just a no-brainer. I mean, what kind of asshole would say that millions and millions of people should die because of inequality? It's ridiculous. The problem is that the ruling class, the capitalist class, controls everything important in the world. They control the food supplies, they control housing, they control banking, they control water, they control electricity, transport, communication, everything. They own everything significant that produces wealth. And this economic control gives them the final say over what goes on politically and in every government. And so for Marxists, the power that's opposed to that, the power that's got the capacity to fight back, is the working class. And so the point of this talk is to explain Marx's arguments in regards to that and, you know, our arguments in regards to that. And so terminologically, just to be clear, Marx also used the term proletariat for the working class. I'll largely use working class. For the capitalists, he called them the bourgeoisie, but I'll typically stick to the capitalists. So before I go and talk about the working class and define it, I actually want to define the opposite. I want to talk about the ruling class and what they do. And I want to take one example in particular, and that's BHP Billiton, which is the largest mining corporation in the world, and it's, I believe, the biggest Australian company. It's got property in 25 different countries, and that spans from Latin America to Africa to Iraq, and of course here, where amongst other things they mine uranium. They employed, these figures are based on the 2008 annual report that BHP Billiton put out, then they employed 39,000 people. And BHP Billiton's overall value was estimated then, if it were to be sold tomorrow, this is what it'd be worth, was $165 billion. In 2008, they turned a before-tax profit of $23 billion. And that was up 27% from the year before that. Now, if that profit had been redistributed to the 39,000 employees of BHP Billiton worldwide, they would have all gotten an annual bonus of $580,000. That didn't happen. Instead, that profit went to the people that already own immense fortunes. Chip Goodyear, for him it was a great year. He was then the CEO of BHP Billiton. He's moved on to greener pastures now. He received his annual salary of $1.7 million. For overtime, life's hard, he got a further $1.5 million. Because he moved on, he retired, he got an $800,000 bonus and $3 million worth of share options. And so, aside from that, $2.7 billion was paid out to the shareholders of BHP Billiton in the form of dividends. And to be clear, these were not mum and dad shareholders. Mum and dad shareholders do not exist. The major shareholders of BHP Billiton, the largest 20 shareholders, who then owned 58% of the company's stock, they are all other corporations, corporations like JP Morgan, ANZ, Mitsubishi. So there's a web of corporate shareholding that goes into owning BHP and BHP Billiton and receiving the profits from it. And that is one example that's illustrative of how modern capitalism works today. Business owners control all of the profits from the company they own. And the thing is, if you think about it, those massively wealthy shareholders, and I suppose you could probably trace it back to individuals at some point, and it'd be really difficult, they haven't seen anything that they own, you know, outside of the pictures in the annual report in BHP Billiton. They've never been to a mine. They've never been to most of the countries where their company owns things. They've never contributed in any way to the work that goes into this company. They don't even do spreadsheets or calculators. You know, they don't even manage it. They pay people to do that. These people are purely owners. They don't contribute to this, to any of the production that goes on. Rather, it is the hard work of miners, engineers, people that work in the service industries that support those people, transportation workers. They are all the ones that contribute to the value that's produced by BHP Billiton. And so this makes an important point. It starts to say that the value that's produced by BHP Billiton comes from labour. And you look further into it, all of the machinery that BHP Billiton relies on, you know, the capital, the investment, all of that is a product of labour too. It's part of a whole web of that. You know, the electricity that runs BHP Billiton's operations, that is a product of labour. And so the picture I'm trying to paint is one of an enormous corporation owned by people who don't do a jot of work, but yet who control all of the profits. To call these people parasites is an insult to parasites. And so this highlights some general points about the economy. The ownership of capital is central to the rulers in this economy. Capital is property that allows the owners to employ workers and produce value. And so that means to say that work is the source of all real value. And workers necessarily do not receive the full value of what they produce. If they had done, they would have all gotten that $580,000 bonus in 2008. So the obvious question is, why do workers accept this shitty deal? It's obviously crap. Simply put, in today's economy, we don't have a choice. In very general sense, if you don't work, you starve. You know, life without a job is pretty difficult to maintain. And so this tells you a central fact about the working class. As workers, we are the source of all profits in the system, yet we do not receive those profits. And we're forced into an exploitative relationship with the capitalist class because we don't own capital ourselves, because we don't own enough property to employ labour or to just make money off it ourselves. So the term wage slave, that's not entirely accurate because, you know, we've got legal freedoms that slaves didn't. But it does encapsulate a certain truth about the nature of the working class under capitalism. But there's more to it than just this. The modern economy relies on enormous cooperation. you know, and you think about what used to exist in the past. You know, for millennia, people survived in productive relationships based on the local family unit or a very localized economy. You know, you think about sort of peasant manufacture. You know, you'd pretty much get by 90% in what was grown or manufactured in your own village. That's different today. Today, the economy is based on an enormous network of cooperation. I'm here because I filled my car up with petrol, which was distilled somewhere from oil that was pumped out of the ground in the Middle East. I ate toast for breakfast. I don't really know where the wheat that went into that toast came from, but it came from somewhere. It was processed somewhere else. It was sold to me in a supermarket. You know, the clothes I'm wearing, everything. It's an enormous network of cooperation, an international network of economic cooperation that goes into providing for our needs today, that goes into production today. And so the point is that we're continually working with people on a massive scale. This society is built on cooperation. It's not built on, you know, individual entrepreneurs. That's crap. It's built on an enormous network of economic cooperation. The second aspect to this is the closer you get to the heart of the system, the bigger the workplaces tend to be. There's a much more of a concentration of labour today than there ever has been before. You know, factories in the eastern and western suburbs of Melbourne will employ hundreds or thousands of workers. Call centres, which tend to be open around the clock, also employ hundreds, if not thousands of workers. Schools can employ hundreds. Universities employ thousands, as do colleges and hospitals, as do the docks, as do transportation networks. You know, thousands of people are brought together. The basic reason for that is that in most cases, it's more efficient for the capitalists to concentrate labour, because it means that they can concentrate the machinery and the means of production. You know, it's more efficient. You know, they don't have to worry about transporting things all over the shop if they can do things in a number of concentrated workplaces. This is key because it brings workers together in large numbers. And so what we've got all over the economy is large numbers of workers cooperating, and in workplaces, large numbers of workers that are cooperating, who are all effectively barred from owning those means of production that they cooperate to use. That's not the end of it. The capitalist class has an interest in reducing our standard of living wherever it can. This is one of the ways that they can send up profits. And it's a basic economic fact. If some auditor, some business manager, you know, probably a graduate from a university like this, can go to a corporation and advise that corporation on how to cut 1,000 jobs or how to reduce wages overall, that company will save potentially millions. Cutting our living standards is good for the capitalist class. On the other hand, maintaining our wages and defending our rights, extending our rights, is good for our class, the working class. So the point I'm making here is that classes aren't just stagnant blocks that exist independently of each other or that just exist in society. It's actually a dynamic relationship which is based on struggle. Our class against theirs, the working class against the capitalist class. Sometimes this isn't as clear. You know, for instance, they'll invoke the national interest to try and say that we've got a common interest. But other times it is clear. For instance, when a strike is on. You know, like, it's funny that the bosses always just happen to object to the reasons for a strike, and the workers always, you know, have an interest in it. And so this pattern of class struggle is a really key point about Marxism. And it's actually, I think, a key weakness of capitalism. They would love to be able to make their money without us. And that's part of the reason why they'll often turn to speculation, you know? Like, they hope that they can make a buck on the share market, but that doesn't produce anything. To produce value, they actually need us. They rely on labour. There's no getting away from this. Without workers, there are no profits. So that's the key. We don't need them. We can do without them. They can't do without us. So that's, actually, I think, a quite optimistic point at the heart of Marxism. And so more than this, though, like, they don't serve any useful purpose in the world anymore. You know, as I said before, like, they're worse than parasites. And their profit system has created wars and economic crisis on an enormous scale. And so everything in the modern economy, you think about it, it's already basically run by us. You know, like, the networks of communication, planning, logistics, all of those kinds of things. You know, even sort of lower management decisions. This is basically not the capitalist class doing the work. You know, by and large, the working class does all of the labour that keeps this system running. Now, the capitalists themselves do have some say over this, of course. And, you know, they've got an enormous amount of economic and political power. But what do they actually contribute productively? Not a lot. Typically, their decisions are based on how to maximise profit and how to screw us over the most. So our strength lies in the fact that the working class is capable of organising production without the property owners. And I think it's beyond doubt that we could do a better job of running the world. So for one, in any given industry or company, the future of the people that work in that company are bound up with the success of the company. This gives us a vested interest in making sure that the world economy functions, that we actually produce properly. However, for the people that own the economy today, they don't have any interest in any such thing. They only have an interest in making money. So if it suits their interest, they will shut down production, or they will produce things that are totally useless. You know, like I was reading an article the other day in the International Socialist Review about food production. The issue with food production is that there's a stagnant level of demand. You know, people can only, well, not stagnant, but it slowly grows. People can only eat so much, you know. So what they do, they hyper-process all of the grain that they grow, you know, and they create effectively nutritionless products to sell people. It's, they don't have any interest in providing for human need. So on the other hand, workers in industries obviously do. You know, we obviously do have an interest in creating things that are useful, and we obviously do have an interest in seeing our workplaces go well. You know, it's a sort of a basic point. And so this is key. It's because the working class is collective, and it's got this interest in producing things that are useful, and that it has to cooperate. There simply isn't room for the kind of selfish individualism in the working class that's so characteristic of the capitalist class. So anyway, I'll come back at the end of the talk to look a bit more at how workers' control and workers' democracy can function. But in the next bit, I'll go over some common objections that sociologist types that I know only too well from my course usually have against Marxism and our understanding of the working class. But to recap, the two main points about the working class are: we're forced by economic necessity to sell our labour to a boss in return for a wage. That's the first basic definition of the working class. The second basic thing is we are a collective class, and that's the key to the Marxist understanding of the working class. So what's the working class population of Australia? Well, there are about 10 million employed people, of whom about 10% would be managerial, so not really working class. A further 21% are categorised as professionals. So you've got to assume that of that, a number would be more or less working class, whereas some are sort of not quite so. So the overall number of workers in Australia is probably about 8 million. If you incorporate dependents, the elderly or children, whose lives depend on that working class core, you start to come to about 16 million working class people in Australia. And that doesn't say anything about the type of work we do. And this is important. Some sociologists put forward the sort of stereotypical definition of working class. You know, you've got to be grubby, blue-collar, probably working in a coal mine or a factory or something to be working class. This doesn't hold. You know, these differences are totally secondary. A teacher or a computer technician, he's just as much working class as a bricklayer. And it doesn't say anything much about what people think of themselves. This is the other argument that people always use. Go, oh, well, there's, you know, maybe the working class exists, but people don't think of themselves as working class. Well, you can think that you're royalty. It doesn't make it so. You know, there's an objective reality to these things that's important. And so the other argument that's often made against Marxism is that the working class is in historic decline. For the most part, this is based on an incorrect definition of the working class. You know, they see someone that works in the service industry like McDonald's and they say it's not working class. Well, I say crap. But, you know, their argument otherwise is based on the argument that manufacturing and heavy industry is in decline. And so the argument that I would make in response to that is that while there have been long-term structural changes in the makeup of the working class in countries like Australia, it is undoubtable that relative to the rest of the economy, manufacturing in Australia has declined. But that to solely look at things like this is quite a Eurocentric point of view. The reality is the whole of the world economy is still based on manufacturing, and that manufacturing takes place all across the world. Some of it's still in the West, but in economies like China or Brazil or India or all throughout the Middle East or in Africa, there's an enormous amount of manufacturing that still goes on. And so, you know, what we can see is a sort of a global division of labour. And this is all a very loose generalisation, though, and I think it's important not to overstate tendencies like this. So, according to the English Marxist Chris Harman, the world's working class is made up of 2 billion people, around which there are another 2 billion or so people whose lives are subject to the same basic logic of the working class, you know, so dependents and things like that. And a detailed study of the world's workforce by Dion Filmer in the mid-90s showed those figures to be basically correct. He calculated that 2,474 million people participated in the global non-domestic labour force in the mid-90s. Around a fifth, 379 million people worked in industry, 800 million in services, and about a billion in agriculture. And over the last century, there's been a major trend towards urbanisation. That is to say, more and more people live in cities. That's important. In 1970, only 37% of the world's population lived in cities. By 95, that had risen to 45%. And this is predicted to increase to 55% by 2015. And this trend is most pronounced in developing nations. For example, in China, on any given year, about 100 million people move from the countryside to the cities to try and find work. And so this trend, internal migration, is common throughout the developing world, as I said. And it's important because it means that all of those people typically end up as either members of the working class or at least part-time members of the working class, working some of the year in the cities and sometimes going back to the countryside for other parts of the year. And so in this sense, even in the first world, the working class overall has actually grown in the last 50 years. And, you know, you take the example of manufacturing in the United States, which relative to the rest of the US economy has been in decline. It's actually grown absolutely, though. In 1950, 20 million workers were employed in industry. Today, there are 30 million in the United States. And there's been a similar increase in other nations. And so the overall picture for the advanced capitalist countries is this. There were 112 million industrial jobs in 1998. And that is 25 million more than they were in 1951. So that paints a pretty comprehensive picture of a growing working global working class. Now, as I mentioned before, there's no sort of iron divide between manual jobs, industry, and the service sector. You know, if you work in a call center, well, you rely on a keyboard, a mouse, a computer. These were all manufactured somewhere. And, you know, a truck driver or a crane operator at the docklands, you know, they don't actually produce anything, but what they produce is a service, which is absolutely key to the economy because things don't move themselves. So, you know, that's all very relevant. Now, another myth that goes around is that there's a precariousness to work today, that because of the globalized economy, it's easy for multinationals to shift overseas. And this undercuts any capacity the working class has to defend its interests because companies can just pick up and go overseas. Now, the grain of truth in that is that is twofold. One, yes, money can go across borders very, very quickly. Investment can flow across borders lightning speed, far quicker than people can go across borders. The other grain of truth is, yes, capitalism has benefited enormously from low wages in the developing world. But it's a massive overstatement when the sociologists argue that this undercuts the Marxist definition of class or the Marxist attitude towards the working class. Because a lot of the time, it's incredibly difficult for a corporation to just set up in another country. I mean, you think if, for instance, in the West, you know, highly technological industries, industries which require an educated workforce, a lot of infrastructure, you know, all of these kinds of things, it would cost them literally billions to pack all of that up and set up overseas. And a lot of the time, they simply can't. You know, economies like Japan and Germany, there's no way that the manufacturing sectors in those economies, which produce extremely advanced goods, could just pack up and set up in a third world country without any infrastructure or a skilled working class. Or with a corporation like BHP Billiton, they can't do it because the ore is in Australian soil. It's not in soil elsewhere. So they can't move overseas. They've got to dig it out of the ground here. They've got no choice. And so, you know, when they argue that corporations can just move overseas, they're massively overstating things. The reality is that's not true. So the final argument that I want to disagree with is the idea that the workers in the first world are too comfortable to struggle. Now, the first thing to say about this is that the people who think this are often very comfortable themselves, and they often don't have much experience of working class life. You know, senior academic salary is not too bad these days. And all of that. But even so, the argument's just not true. Australian workers do have a higher standard of living, commensurate to the rest of the world, that's true. But this doesn't translate into complacency or comfort. Union membership in Australia is still around 20%, just above 20%. And it peaked in the 1970s at over 50%. And yet, this came after a period of boom. So actually, a strengthening economy, workers could see that there was money to go around, so they demanded it. Living standards had been improving, and yet people struggled to better their living standards. So relative comfort doesn't equal passivity. I mean, even then, it's highly dubious what the sociologists think comfort is. Struggle isn't born of poverty. It's born of, often, workers thinking that they're entitled to more than what they're getting. But the other thing is today, in Australia people aren't held back because we're comfortable. We've got some of the highest working hours in the Western world. You know, like, I've never met a teacher or a nurse or, you know, a construction worker who will say, oh, yeah, I would strike, but really I'm just too comfortable. You know, I enjoy my AFL or my, you know, washing machine too much to strike. This is rubbish. Like, actually, most people are extremely stressed at work. Most people would jump at the opportunity to have shorter hours and a higher wage. You know, this is just basic. So the main thing that holds people back today is more political than, you know, some general sociological thing. And by political, I mean it's more often than not the union leadership that's unwilling to lead struggles. And, you know, this is because the union leadership is it's in the Labor Party and they're in the government and they don't want to upset things. You know, like, I was at a strike a number of years ago, a teacher's strike. It was amazingly, you know, the sense of solidarity there was impressive. You know, all of the teachers there were absolutely committed to the strike. It only ended because the union leaders called it off much earlier than it could have been. You know, that's the sad reality for a lot of the situation in the unions today. And so the other aspect to this is it's quite easy to see how the economic crisis that's gripping the world can spread to Australia. And this could force people to defend their living standards. And if the Chinese economy were to contract by 1%, not much for China, this would fuck Australia over big time, because pretty much the Australian economy is only still growing because we sell minerals and that to China. And so the government would have to make a tax in order to balance the books, in order to avoid national bankruptcy. And this would mean we could well be forced to fight back. And I'll look at exactly how that's playing out in Greece in just a second. So the point of this talk isn't to argue, though, that workers are continually struggling or that workers are always just, you know, up for a fight and it's only the union leaders that hold them back. That's not really true. You know, capitalism couldn't function if there were a continual level of radical struggle or radicalisation in the working class. You know, and there are real factors that can hold people back from struggle. People at times can be scared of the consequences of struggling. You know, they can be scared that they'll lose their jobs as a result of it, or underconfident that they'll be supported by the wider community. You know, that's a wedge that the government always uses, for instance, to attack nurses when they're on strike. You know, they say that nurses don't give a shit about the people that they should be treating by going on strike, which is rubbish, but it's a, you know, designed to intimidate the nurses and try and convince other workers not to support them. You know, and in other countries, you know, it's not the ideas that hold people back, but it's the fear of repression, state repression. You know, in a place like Egypt or China, not that it's holding the working class back in those two countries. They've sort of, you know, made it such that the government is reluctant to use mass repression. But in other countries, you know, repression can mean that people are too scared to fight back, even if they want to. And so I'm not going to go through in this talk all of the different ways in which these barriers can be overcome. Suffice to say that they have been overcome in virtually every situation imaginable in the past. And this is because the class struggle is a part of capitalism. It's a continually recurring part of capitalism. And if you look at the history of any country, you are hard-pressed to find 50 years of stability. Really hard-pressed to find 50 years of stability. Social peace is very, very difficult to come by. And this is because of capitalism's fatal weakness. It relies on us. And so in the last part of this talk, I'll talk about Greece. Thing is, whenever I give a talk like this, I use the most contemporary example. Last time I gave this talk, I talked about Egyptian workers, so this time I'm talking about Greek workers because they're actually doing this at the moment. And so, in Greece, they've got economic problems. These are largely created by the global financial crisis. Greece has an enormous national debt, and its deficit is really high. And the bankers of Central Europe really eager to see the Greek government, so countries like Germany, are pressuring the Greek government to make huge cuts to the budget, basically cuts to the working class's living standards, so that they can get their money back. And the socialist government of Greece, reformist socialist government of Greece, is all too happy to oblige. Now, as a side point, Greek businesses have managed to evade about over $20 billion of euros worth of tax in the last little while. You know, I read that stat based on the analysis of a Greek socialist, a revolutionary socialist. But the government doesn't want to go after their money. Oh, no, the government wants to go after the money of the Greek working class. And so the cuts that they've introduced are a freeze on pensions for the second year in a row, salary cuts for public employees that are expected to take place in the private sector as well, tax increases, an increase in the sales tax on basic items like food and petrol. And these cuts have been met with massive demonstrations, really massive demonstrations. Workers from all sectors have marched on the streets, and the police in a couple of instances have tried to use tear gas or to beat people, but this has utterly backfired. It's just sort of thrown fuel on the fire of anger. On March 11th, the second general strike of the year took place. You know, a general strike is when all industry shuts down, or, you know, a majority of industry shuts down, a majority of sectors shut down. The second general strike took place on March 11th. And previously quite moderate unions led by the reformist socialists, the equivalent of the Labour Party, were actually forced by their membership in a lot of instances to back the strike and call their workforces out as well. Teachers, public servants, nurses, bank workers, dock workers, transport workers, media workers, rail workers, just to name a few, were all on strike. That is a perfect cross-section of the working class in a Western economy. Since then, protests have been taking place almost daily in many of the cities of Greece. In some areas, workers have actually stormed and occupied buildings. They've occupied the finance ministry, and this is one that's particularly cool, because Greek law requires that any new law be printed in an official newspaper before it become law. The Greek workers have occupied the printing shop of that newspaper, so none of the budget cuts can actually be made into law. That's intelligent. Students have been involved. Temporary workers, for instance, in Athens, have occupied the government job agency, demanding that they don't have temporary jobs, that they be given permanent jobs. And so, you know, this shows a real degree of radicalism and militancy. The Socialist Party has been desperate to get people to go off strike and to stop demonstrating. That's the Reformist Party. They've been pressuring the union leaders, who are typically aligned with this party, to get workers to stop striking, because, you know, like the ruling class, you wouldn't want to be the ruling class of Greece at the moment. You've got the Germans breathing down your neck on the one side and the working class threatening social revolution on the other side. And so in response to this, what's actually been happening, workers have been organising local struggle committees. It's fantastic. Now, the push for these committees was actually initiated by the far left. They're the ones that had the suggestion, but since then it's gone way beyond the far left. And, you know, these struggle committees have been set up in a lot of cities and a lot of areas basically to give people a voice and to make sure that their movement's not co-opted or sold down the road by the union leaders. There are examples of these committees in particular in Athens, and one, for instance, represents a cross-section, high school teachers, workers at the local Red Cross, members of an anti-racist campaign group, a pro-immigrant campaign group, students and just local residents. Now, these committees are in early days yet, and their main role is to coordinate the struggle. You know, they haven't taken over the job of running society yet. But the point is, and, you know, we can't predict how far they'll go. You know, I just don't know enough about the actual situation on the ground to say whether or not they can escalate or what. But the fact is, this is how workers' democracy is born. And there are a number of historical examples of this. This is where working-class democracy and control comes from. It's this kind of initiative, this kind of rank-and-file initiative towards running things. And, you know, this in my mind is proof, more than anything, that the working class is a class still able to shape capitalism and run the world. And this pattern is one that's happened time and time again across the 20th century. And, you know, there's a number of examples. In the Russian Revolution in 1905 and 1917, similar councils were set up and actually became national workers' councils. The Soviets, they were called. In Germany and Italy in the 20s, this happened. In France and Spain in the 30s, this happened. In Eastern Europe, after World War II, in Hungary in the 50s, in Paris and in Prague in the 1960s, in Portugal and Iran in the 70s, right up to similar things in Egypt, in Bolivia, in Venezuela, and you know, other examples that I haven't been able to think of. This happens. When there's workers' struggle on such a great degree, it naturally pushes towards the creation of workers' democracy and committees, that collective democratic bodies that represent that workers' democracy. So only a class with the same economic... the same collective interest. Only a class with no interest in exploitation or oppression could achieve this. Only a class with the economic power of the working class could put this into action and could make it effective through their economic power. All of the skills and training that go into running capitalism can be put into running this kind of workers' democracy. So the question for us is, how do we make these workers' councils permanent? And that means a revolution. And that's, again, another talk or something that people might want to talk about in the discussion. But the point is, we can organise this kind of workers' democracy, and once we've done so, we'll be able, instead of slaving for some asshole capitalist that, you know, owns a mansion in Toorak and millions of dollars, we'll actually be able to work for the betterment of humanity and human need.